Hello, this is a GMS Magazine podcast. My name is Sean Harris. And
I am Michael Garcia.
Yes. And we're here for the special Halloween episode where we'll be talking about horror and role-playing games, representation, and all other topics surrounding that. So, Paco was kind enough to kind of give me the reins for this episode. Number one, because I was super excited about it. And number two, I'm a horror fan, and therefore, I could talk about this all day. So I guess I want to start with, like, are you a horror fan in general, or do you like not mind horror? Or like...
No, I absolutely love it. The only problem I have with horror is that I don't see the point in gratuitous gore in movies. Mm-hmm. And I have watched so many horror films that it's very difficult to actually scare or shock me. It's very difficult for a movie to do that. But I absolutely love it.
Oh, great. Same here. I agree with you about, like, the gore thing. And there's also horror, and then there's torture porn, which is, like, no thanks.
Yeah.
It's just... and I'm a big fan of, like, the classic horror stuff. Like, I love a good monster movie.
Oh, yeah.
Like, give me a vampire or a werewolf eating people up.
I'm in heaven. Love that.
I'm not too keen. Well, I mean, of course, of late, like, there have been some trends in horror that kind of, like, make me roll my eyes a bit. Like, there's a lot of zombie stuff.
Yes.
And vampires have been thoroughly defanged, as have werewolves. And I'm kind of sad about that. But yeah, like, do you, how much do you include, like, horror in your role-playing games or horror elements?
Quite a lot. I do like it an awful lot. It depends an awful lot on whether I am playing or whether I am directing. If I'm playing the game, then I have to go with it. And my friends tend to be a lot milder than I am when it's about horror. When I run the game, I tend to be pretty horrific in the way that I conduct and create the stories. But I like leaving an awful lot of blank spaces for people to fill up out of their own volition. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, the last time I was playing a horror game, I was playing a game called Something Wicked.
Right.
And essentially the story that was... growing, because it's a very improvisational kind of game. It was to do with some insects that parasitically inhabit humans so they can then reproduce. So when I said that they use men and women as hosts of their eggs, that's all I said. And when I said to my friends, you go into the room and you find this man who's hanging from the wall and he's being used as a host for the eggs. I don't need to say anything else. They imagine whatever it is they have in their heads that they can be like. Mm. And usually I get a, oh, that's gross kind of reaction, which I like.
Oh, yeah. It's been a while since I've actually had, like, a horror game. I think the last time was, like, way back in old World of Darkness. I did, like, a Wraith thing. Oh, wait. Well, no, that is... Okay, I had a Primetime Adventures game that was a riff on... What was it? Camp Big Rock or something? It was that short film set in Jurassic World with a dinosaur. They're, like, wandering around eating people. I had something like that. But it wasn't really horror. It was more like kind of an adventure, a tense adventure thing where, like, yeah, nobody's special forces. You're not the most powerful people in the planet. You're just kids at camp.
Right.
And you're facing off against, like, T-Rexes and stuff. I really like horror. When I find that, I don't know if this is true about you, but do you think that in role-playing games that horror is kind of hard to pull off because of the player agency factor? And a lot of what makes horror work is, like, being in a situation where you're not necessarily in control.
I think so, but also because I reckon it's very easy to fall into the easy bits of horror. With the easy bits of horror being what you were mentioning about torture porn, you know, that kind of situation where gratuitous violence or graphic, you know, dismemberment is used to create disgust. And to me, that can be horrific, but it's not really horror. I think you're right in that losing a sense of control and confronting yourself against something that is incommensurably bigger and more powerful than you is a theme that I do like a lot in horror. So it isn't easy to do. It isn't easy to imbue a game where people, where players are, you know, invulnerable. The players are invulnerable. The characters are not, but the players, nothing's going to happen to them, and they know it. To instill that sense of horror, I find it quite difficult.
And I think maybe horror, because horror is dealing with like such a primal, personal, emotional thing. Like, it's about evoking fear, and fear works differently for different people, and they respond to fear in different ways. And it's so personal. It's like, it's so context dependent, and so much of that depends on the group you're with and the players you're with and the kind of relationship you have with them. Because, like, you know, if you're like a casual game at a con, I don't know how well a like deeply immersive horror story is going to work. But then again, I did play Ten Candles with people I haven't played with before, and that worked well. So.
I haven't played Ten Candles, but I think you put a finger in it. The context matters an awful lot because, I mean, for example, a swarm of spiders in D&D is going to have a much less horrific effect usually than a swarm of spiders in a game like Call of Cthulhu or World of Darkness.
Right.
You know, the context of the whole thing makes it, I don't know, harder to deal with, more horrific to deal with for the players and the characters, I think.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Now I have to think about, like, gee, I wonder if I want to do that to my players, like, make giant spiders scary again. And it means something different, too, if, like, if you're dealing with, you know, a group where you have someone who has severe arachnophobia.
Well, yes.
Versus what? Well, yeah, I like spiders well enough. It's like, okay, they're creepy crawlies, but I'm not terrified of them. And yeah, it's like, okay, so I'm going to spring Sheila on the arachnophobe and how to handle that. Which I guess kind of segues into like another kind of topic that I was going to like bring up with you. It's like about boundaries and taboos and how we do those in horror. Because, you know, yes, you want the play experience to be safe for the players, yet horror as a genre is about undermining safety.
Correct. That is a very tricky one. And I have this conversation with an awful lot of people who refuse flatly to have any kind of, you know, X card or that sort of thing. But I reckon, firstly, you must unarguably explain to the players the extent of the horror that you want to go as a storyteller. Mm-hmm. I think that is absolutely paramount, because no one at any point should find any kind of surprise when playing a game, and everybody should have the power to say, I don't want to play this. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that is pretty important. And to be honest, I don't know how often that happens, especially at convention rounds and places like that. Mm-hmm. That's kind of worrying at times.
Yeah, and it's like, well, and it's like, and I think, for instance, like when we're talking about things like sexual assault or abuse and whatnot, mm-hmm. and to justify like the X card thing makes intuitive sense to people. But then we're dealing with horror, and it's like, well, you know, like, again, people's personal fears, and we're dealing with, like, their squick levels, and, like, and it can be a little more fuzzy in a way. Like, it's like, where is it fun to play with your personal fears, and when is it like, okay, not even no longer fun, but like actively unfun to play with your personal fears? It's like me when I'm watching, there was this movie that, it's actually this European film that this European horror film that I watched that I should have known from the trailer it was not for me because it had bugs in it. And I'm not a bug thing. I'm not a bug person. And and there were a lot more bugs in the movie than there were in the trailer.
Right, okay.
There was a collection of them, and it's like, okay, it's like, I can handle ghosts and demons and like strange alien beings from beyond the stars. I can handle things eating people. I can handle things like possessing people. I guess I can handle a lot of this, but like, but just say no to the fucking bugs. I can't deal with it. I can't look at that. I can't. The fun of the horror, or like that, you know, it went from kind of, you know, it's not fun for me. It became genuine distress. And, you know, and that's not what I look at horror to experience. And it's like I can handle a lot of stuff where it's like, where it challenges me, where it's like kind of says, okay, well, this notion that you have is not as sacrosanct as you think it is. It's like, okay, I can deal with that, but like the bugs, no thank you.
But that's the sort of thing that needs to be made very, very clear from the start, because I am the one for changing an awful lot of things in my story, so I don't have an issue with it. But I can understand if somebody has made a story about, you know, in books in the middle of a jungle, to get rid of those bugs could be very hard. So I can understand somebody wanting to say, well, no, this is what the story is all about. You can play it or you can live it, but I cannot change this.
Right.
And I would go, okay, yeah, that's fair. I don't want to play it. So I can see why horror, and what kind of horror is not for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to be said, you know, right away.
Yeah.
But I reckon, well, there's some special kind of allowances that should be permissible for horror games, you know, like stopping the game if things get hard. It should be doable, you know. I know enough of the people who say, well, you know, if you don't like the game, just stand up and leave. And that's a bit
drastic.
It's a little bit drastic, and it's also very rude, you know. Okay, if you feel like you want to leave, stop the game, say your farewells, and you know, then continue playing, have a break, ask for some feedback, you know, treat the person as if they are a human being in distress rather than a disposable asset.
Right. Right. And, you know, and it's like, and like anything, it's, you know, horror, yes, but like with anything, it's like something that like, on paper, you might be cool with, and some things that, like, when you start playing with it, it's like, I don't know, I'm not getting, I'm kind of sliding into a not good place as this goes on. It's like, and then sometimes it's not even about leaving either. It's like such a, like you said, you just need a breather, or you need like,
right,
like, just calm down a bit and kind of separate the reality from the fiction. Okay, yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, people always come first, then the game.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. And that in horror is even more. You know, I had an experience once a few months ago before the confinement where I was playing a game that is played in the dark.
Okay? Right.
And we can talk about how to make your games horrific somehow. And in the game, I used a strobe light to illuminate some photographs of zombies and some creatures that these people find in the bunker where they have been trapped.
Right.
And one of the players, immediately after I did it for the first time, he asked me to stop. And he said, "Don't, please don't." And he said, to me, "Well, I had a heart attack about 3 years ago, and having these kind of scares, these kind of jumps, it could actually kill me."
Okay.
So, can you please not kill me?
Okay.
And I thought, in fairness, I think I'd rather you don't die, so I will stop doing this. So it is really important that sometimes it's not just the content, but it's also the format in which you present the content.
Right.
That you have to be very careful. You know, I am very physical with my games.
Right.
You know, I would be the one to, you know, throw water at my players, you know, just a sparkle of water at my players when, you know, somebody's, you know, you slash someone, well, even when playing D&D, you slash somebody and just blood spills all over you and just splash some water over them.
Like all the viscera from the monsters they kill.
Correct, you know. So sometimes the format in which the horror takes place, you have to be a little bit careful on that front because it can have some very, very serious consequences.
Right. that's such a commonsensical thing. I don't know why this sometimes gets so controversial. I was like, okay, I don't want anybody like to die at my game. It'd be a hell of a story, but I'm like, it's not the kind of...
I know, I like drama, but the thing is, that kind of thing is the sort of stories that make it to the media.
Yeah.
You know, suddenly, playing role-playing games would be, you know, Russian D&D. Mm-hmm. Who's going to survive? Who's going to die this time? You know, who's going to roll the die that will kill you? It's a bit, I don't want that to happen. Okay. Not the point. Yeah.
We don't need a retread of like Satanic Panic or anything like that.
Recto.
Yeah, I mean, like Harry Potter notwithstanding, and we're not going to talk about Miss Rowling. We're not going to talk about Miss Rowling.
No.
Or Joanne, we're not going to talk about her.
No, she can go fuck herself. Sorry.
See? but yeah, it's just, it's just kind of like, well, yeah, you just have, yeah, you have these things that, like you said, it's just, you know, you're like, kind of, you know, be compassionate. I didn't say, like, everybody's here to have fun, you know, and there's, like, and I guess, like, part of the issue, I guess, or I wouldn't say issue, but I wonder, too, if, like, because, like, so, role-playing as a hobby is kind of a safe haven for a ton of people who are not necessarily good at social cues.
Mm-hmm.
And especially with horror, because you kind of need to have a certain awareness of social cues in order to affect, you know, to create a safe yet fun and scary atmosphere, or safe yet fun and scary experience. And I wonder, if like some of the pushback we've seen with some of the things that we've talked about, like just, you know, like, yeah, just talk to people, like just talk to the person, as opposed to like, well, what do I do if my player is doing all this? And it's like, well, just talk to them. you can address it to them. You know, you don't have to make everything like this sort of in-game consequence for out-of-game stuff. Or it's like, well, my player said that blah, blah, blah made them uncomfortable. What do I do? It's like, well, you talk to them and,
yeah,
you know, you try to come up with a solution that works for both of you. And, you know, and then again, it's sort of like, and then sometimes it's like, what do you mean talk to people? like sometimes, and it's like, trying to manipulate. I will say this, and I'm going to make this very clear. And this is not just about horror, but this is about any kind of role-playing scenario, any kind of static in a role-playing game. It's like, do not try to use the game to resolve personal issues.
No, oh God, no, that has to be done so carefully. No.
Never do it. I mean, if a person has a problem with your game, they need to be able to talk to you, and you need to be able to talk to them.
Mm.
And if you aren't able to handle an adult conversation like that, I would think twice about gaming with that person. Like, even, and it doesn't mean you have to be mean or anything. It's just like, if you can't trust that you can have a say, hey, this thing that you did in the game kind of rubbed me the wrong way. Is there, and I know you probably didn't mean anything by it. It's like, if that's not going to like lead to a big, huge explosion at your table, then you need to kind of reevaluate the company you keep.
I definitely agree with that. I think, even if not everybody is an adult, around the table, you know, some people are younger than others. Although, to be honest, I think we're going to have a conversation. I mean, as to what it means nowadays to be adults, because I have friends who are in their early 20s who are way more adults than their parents who are my age.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's something that we need to talk about at some point, but. Everybody can behave at some point and to some degree like an adult. And adults talk. We discuss things. We communicate as best we possibly can. And if something is not working around the table, if there is something that you want to do or try to do, that needs to be communicated. But if you start your game, especially a horror game, with an intent that's not disclosed, you are threading into very, very murky waters, and that can be very dangerous.
Right. Yeah. Because, you know, because like in many things, you know, consent matters, you know? And and it's not just about, you know, sex or romantic relationships. It's like what kind of gaming experience you're signing up for. If you, it's like anything, like, and I'll give you a very easy example where it's like, okay, we're going to play a game of D&D and the party, the PCs are the heroes. You know, you don't come in with your chaotic evil person, your chaotic evil character, you know, killing and pillaging left and right in that game because the rest of the players didn't sign up for an evil campaign. They signed up for a heroic fantasy campaign. Exactly. So, It's not a similar thing where it's like, okay, I signed up for fun scary, not give me nightmare scary. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was like, I signed up for Shaun of the Dead. I didn't sign up for, like, The Walking Dead. It's like, I got you.
Exactly, but that has to be said. And something else that matters an awful lot, going back a little bit into the... What can constitute horror? An awful lot of people think that politically incorrect things are horrific, which is when people will put in, you know, rape or child murder or that sort of thing, which you thinking, oof. These things are horrific, but they're very, very close to reality. They're too close to the bone. So you have to be very careful when threading on those things. So, yeah, consent and a fair amount of common sense, I think, are paramount to have a successful horror campaign.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of, like, specific content, like you know, sexual violence or child abuse and things like that. I do have games that include content like that. And it's sort of like, and as much as I would love to like play those games, it's like, well, it has to be the right group of people. Because I can't just spring that on people and be like, here, deal with this. This situation that may have touched on trauma that you never revealed to me because it's none of my business. So it's like, you know, and I guess that kind of segues into like specific horror RPGs. And it's like, and I know most of the time it's like when people talk about horror, so what are your favorite horror RPGs? And I'm not going to ask that question. That question has been asked enough. You can look it up on the internet. Google will tell you all the horror RPGs you can possibly find. But I do want to like kind of like segue into and sort of address, especially with what's on television nowadays, because Lovecraft Country is my jam. And of course the ubiquitous horror RPG is Call of Cthulhu. I've never played it in recent memory. I might have played like one session of it way back. But so and then there's like when we talk about Call of Cthulhu and Lovecraft Country, we gotta be talking about representation and horror and stuff. So it's how do I say this? When it comes to horror RPGs, what are like some things that you're looking for when you say, okay, this is something I definitely want to pick up, or versus I'll leave this one on a shelf?
Well, personally, I do like my psychological horror. I look into what sensations I can provide to my players. Mm-hmm. And I like to anxiety. Mm-hmm. is an emotion that I draw on very, very often. I try to make my players anxious and nervous. Mm-hmm. About what they could or could not find. And I like to unsettle them a lot. So right. I will use, for instance, I will say you go into a room and you have this overwhelming scent of yellow. Mm-hmm. What do you mean? What do you mean? But you can't smell a color. Yes, you can. You're smelling it. You're getting into the room and you're smelling the color. Or simply you hear triangles. Mm-hmm. What's that supposed to mean?
Like,
so I play with it very, very much.
Right. And then when you draw on anxiety, do you find that it creates, that it leads to players making more interesting choices as opposed to like, if you like anxiety, like as a general feeling, because of like, to me, like anxiety as an emotion can lead me into some pretty interesting directions player wise, where it's like, okay, it's not always, let me do what's most logical in this situation, or let me do what's most advantageous to me in this situation. It's more like, okay, so how do I make this thing go away? Or either the thing that's causing me the anxiety or the feeling itself. And I'm wondering, like, do you notice that when you play with anxiety in your games?
Yes, because they, one of the ways I have to play with anxiety is to play with time.
Mm-hmm.
And to play with music. So mm-hmm. I would put in the background music that would be very quick, very unsettling, very dissonant. Mm-hmm. And what I notice is that they make decisions a lot quicker and a lot more selfish.
Mm-hmm.
They think more about what their character would do and how their character would do it rather than what the group actually needs.
Mm-hmm.
Which increases the anxiety level, because the players, you know, get a bit, but if you do that, then let's do that. And everybody throws ideas a lot more quickly. So it can become hard to manage around the table sometimes. But generally what I find is that they make decisions quicker and way, way less logically.
And then speaking of which, for the heart, well, anxiety, like I said, is like you said, is like a really interesting emotion to play with. And I wonder how, like especially when you're dealing with like more experienced players, especially players in the vein of like D&D or any kind of game where characters get more powerful as the game goes on. And more power means like more influence over the story and more agency and more options in certain situations. Like, I wonder, how do you kind of overcome that tendency to think in that mindset where it's okay, I'm going to do the thing that's, well, I know I have this skill and this ability and therefore, you know, I can control the outcome in this way. Let me translate this into simpler terms. Mm-hmm. How do you get players out of that kind of D&D dungeon crawl mindset in these horror games?
Well, firstly, they don't advance as quickly and they never become that powerful. But also the way that I tend to do these things is by giving them a no easy exit route. So, for instance, I wouldn't allow them to rest as often. I play with the uncertainty. So if you decide that you need a rest, you can do it here. But if you do it here, then you don't know what's going to happen. And the likelihood is that something will happen. So they get this sense that they're running out of resources, that they're running out of stamina, that whatever it is, even if they're incredibly powerful, without the right resources to confront whatever it is they need to confront, they are weak. You know, it's like, I don't know, if the, say in the Call of Cthulhu, the mafioso who's turned investigator, it doesn't matter how good they are at shooting at people. If they run out of bullets, it doesn't matter how good you are.
Right.
So that's how I tend to play with them. You know, what do you need? What is it that makes you powerful? That I am going to make as finite as possible.
Right. Yeah.
How do you do it?
I'm trying to think the last time I actually ran a straight up horror game. I mean, I don't necessarily play with anxiety specifically, but the last time I had like a decision like that where it was like this is not a horror game, but it was in a similar vein. I ran a D&D one-shot adventure based loosely on Die Hard. And the thing about the first Die Hard, the original Die Hard, is that, I mean, I think most people think McClane is mostly about the smart alecky one-liners and stuff. It's like, that's not what made the original Die Hard so good. What made it so good is that he was literally barefoot throughout the movie. He didn't have an arsenal of weapons at his disposal. He was just one cop facing off against, you know, with, okay, he had one gun and one, like, with some bullets in it. And he's, like, barefoot facing off against well-funded, well-equipped, well, they called themselves terrorists, but they were bank robbers, okay? Like, against an enemy that was, like, much... And there were more of them, okay? And so, like, the thing that made John McClane, like, an interesting character was how vulnerable he was. And through, like, the first half of the film, his main objective was to get help.
Yes.
It was not to kill these people or, like, to save everybody. It was to get help. Like, get a fire department. Like, he tried to get the fire department. He tried to get the cops. It's like, and the thing is, the kind of ironic thing is, like through regular old human laziness and bungling up a situation that could have been well in hand very quickly, spiraled out of control. And then the media gets involved, and like, it makes everything worse. And he's walking around with he's walking around barefoot, and when he gets shot, it hurts. And when he steps on glass on his bare feet, that hurts. And so when I did that Die Hard-esque thing, and yes, I made the elves the bad guys. in Die Hard, it was like they were very good looking, well dressed terrorists. So I was like, let's make them elves. So I did that. And with that, it's like, yeah, you start off with no gear. Like, no, you have nothing. You have no spell components. You have no weapons. You have no armor. If you're going to have those things, you're going to have to get it. And that really cut down on the cavalier nature of the violence. When it happened, like, they were a lot more cautious. They started thinking outside the box. They're like, okay, I can't just hit it with my longsword. So what do I do? Okay. And they worked together and they planned and they like did things that they normally wouldn't do. But yeah, there was that. And before that, I think I ran a, I played in a World of Darkness campaign, Precinct 13, when I was living in Shanghai. And that was really cool because the GM was amazing. Oh, the storyteller was amazing. And yeah, Barry, hat tip to Barry. He did things where it was like, at the time, the situation looked one way. And then through some means, got another view of it. Like, it's like those moments in like J-horror or K-horror where it's like, it looks normal at first, but then you like think about it and you backtrack and then you realize like there's a person in the frame that you overlooked. You know what I mean?
Mm.
Yeah, it's like stuff like that where it's like, at first blush, it doesn't seem scary, but then it's sort of like, wait a minute, I completely overlooked this thing. How did I manage that? and so, yeah. And that was very creepy. What else did I do horror-wise? Oh, I did an It thing.
Oh.
That was when I was living in Brooklyn. I did an It thing. It was like World of Darkness. And it was like based on, and I did a thing based on Stephen King's It, where like there was a corrupting influence at the heart of a small town. And yeah, I did the thing with, and like you, I brought props and stuff. I had like a balloon.
Well, props are absolutely fantastic to create horror, yeah. And we so often forget it. I mean, people, seriously, and you have to be very careful when using this, but if you've never used a strobe light in the darkness, you're missing out so much.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Seriously. It's amazing to use a strobe when you're playing in dark. And just playing in the darkness, you know, just letting people, the only light source you have is going to be the screen from your phones. And if you run out of battery, then you're screwed.
Right. Yeah, I like to do, I love doing stuff like that. Like, I like those small yet powerful immersive techniques because it does something to players psychologically. And it's like, well, you just make it all. It's like, and I love theater of the mind. I love it. But like a good physical thing, it can really set you up in the right direction. Because when I played Tin Candles, like the little tea lights were the only lights in the vicinity. So once those go out, that's it. That's the end of the game and something horrible happens to everyone. And it got to that, it sort of like immediately immersed you in that telling stories around a campfire vibe. And now that I think about it, the next time I run a horror game, when we are no longer confined to our homes, I'm going to do something like that where, okay, we're going to have flashlights or something where it's like, look, this is it. And I have little electric candles too. So, and the batteries just soak up at those things. I'm actually going to try something like that.
I think that works so well. Also, another thing that works very well is try to use elements that are known in reality to the players. So, for instance, if you're playing a murder scene. If the murder is described, for instance, I did this once to great effect. I described the scene in a place that we used to go camping.
Mm-hmm.
I describe exactly the same buildings and the same tents where they were and the same everything. And I explained where the body had appeared.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, I'm never going to go to that place and it's never going to be the same again. Because now I'm going to feel that this is the place where we found this body.
Right.
And that helps relate to the scene at home. So it's quite important to all describe people that they actually know, work colleagues or neighbors. It's great to do that sort of thing, to scare and give a sense of verisimilitude and reality to the games.
Oh, yeah, I think that grounding in reality actually is critical. Because then you have something to compare it to, and then you know something is wrong.
Correct.
Versus something where it's completely fabricated, and you're not so, it doesn't, that sense of wrongness doesn't permeate the way it would otherwise. And it's just so, excuse me. And it is like such a, it's so effective. We give it a, like, something, like, rooted in something real.
Mm.
And it's like, even something like, for instance, Alien, which literally takes place in outer space. The, being a working stiff on a rickety vessel is something that a lot of people can relate to. Or the whole working stiff element. Like, no, you work for this corporation who may as well be light years away. And they don't care about you. You're kind of stuck in this situation. You have to make the best of it. And you don't have all these resources. You don't have, and you have to make do with what you have. And you're around your coworkers all the time. And you're in this tight, enclosed space, whether it's an office, a submarine, or what have you. And then on down, you have something eating people. So, and then you have this other threat. So even though it takes place in outer space, it's grounded in something very like human and very real, and like it's an experience that a lot of people can relate to.
Absolutely. I think Alien in particular plays very well to the claustrophobia.
Mm-hmm.
And the impotence, you know. In Alien, it's pretty obvious that you're fighting an enemy that's way over you, but the real enemy is not the alien himself. It's actually the corporation that doesn't care about you and is not just not helping, it's actually hindering you so they can get away with what they want because you don't matter. So you fight in two fronts. There's a massive sense of impotence. There's a massive sense of claustrophobia in all places. And there's a massive sense of resilience, you know, that it's permeable throughout the whole film, which is, I think, that is why it's so, so masterful.
Mm-hmm.
But I reckon, you know, talking about Lovecraft Country, I think a very good exercise to do in horror games is to challenge players' privilege.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the fighting against something that it shouldn't be something you have to fight against.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't matter what kind of horror game you're playing. If the police present themselves as abusive,
mm-hmm.
it's a level of horror. It may not be supernatural. And that's something else that when we think horror, we tend to think of supernatural. But there can be some very real, very natural horror to confront. You know, imagine what it might be like to be told, if you're still in the street, when the sign goes down, we're going to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not given the right resources to actually be undercover
mm-hmm.
when the sign goes down. And there's no reason to be killed other than they just want to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
Just because they can.
Yeah. It's a horror on a different level. It's like which I think Lovecraft Country does masterfully. The show has some criticisms, but I'm not gonna dig into that right now. That would be a completely separate podcast.
I think we should do it though. We should do a podcast at some point and just talk about Lovecraft Country and what it has to offer to role playing games. I think that would be amazing.
Oh yeah. That's really definitely. But speaking of Lovecraft Country and what it can offer, there's the representation thing. And in horror as a genre, minority people sometimes get the shorter end of the stick. You know, whether queer coding the bad guy or like the black guy dies first, or even you know, the way like other cultures are villainized or exotified in a way where it's like the reason why these things are happening is because it's those people versus like what do you say, something where I was like, well, it's something more universally human, so to speak. I'm just wondering, like how, I mean, aside from saying, okay, your player characters can be whatever race, gender, or whatever, as far as representation and horror, like, where do you see opportunities that people aren't really taking advantage of, as far as that's concerned?
Oof, that's a very, very good question, because the issue I have with most horror is how they use stereotypes. Yeah, I really don't like the concept of the voodoo witch.
Right.
You know, so I think opportunities, I tend to play an awful lot with history. So, for example, the adventure that I'm writing at the moment is an adventure called Cosplay. And it plays with the Spanish Civil War. Mm. And how some army people in the Spanish Civil War tried to do something really dark with some dark magic to win the war.
Mm-hmm.
And that's left some, consequences that have been felt to this day, and the players get drawn into them. So I tend to play with that sort of thing, you know, what will happen, but what if historical situations had gone completely wrong? Mm-hmm. But also, because, you know, my background, I look very much into the religion I know. Mm-hmm. You know, into the horrific religious past that I am aware of. What would happen if that religious past was actually in the religious present?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's an awful lot of opportunity to be had in urban myths and urban legends,
mm-hmm,
that we all have in our
hearts. Candyman! Sorry.
Mm. Yes.
Sorry. I just had to put that out there. We talk about urban legends of, like,
yeah, but that sort of thing, they happen. I mean, you know, in my town, we have an awful lot of legends. We have one in particular that there was a deformed child,
mm-hmm,
that was trapped by their parents in a building, and the child would just cry and cry and cry in the window. And sometimes some people saw the child's deformed face in the window. That never happened in town, but it became really famous to the point that we had magazines, you know, reporters from the occult magazines coming to write about it. We're talking in the late 70s, early 80s.
Right.
It transpired that there were birds full of owls screaming and shouting.
Ah.
And that was it.
Uh-huh. And
people invented everything else around it.
Mm.
But the myth endures, you know, and you can still go by that window and people will that there was a child with elephantiasis being trapped by the parents and the child died in there and the ghost screams.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of legends, everybody has legends like that.
Right.
And they can be absolutely fascinating for adventure creation.
Yep. Barn owls in general are kind of weird looking, especially when they're babies. They're weird looking. It's like, I think someone showed a clip of some barn owl, like a cluster of barn owls. Like, they're not hatchlings, but they were juveniles. They did not have flight feathers yet. And like,
no.
And they showed it and they look, I swear, if they were, they look like little gray aliens with no arms. Like, you know, those little gray men, like the aliens, like the popular conception of an alien with the, like the tear shaped head and the big eyes and like the scrawny body.
Yep. I remember that photograph and I thought, my God.
Yeah.
This is so, yeah. So spooky.
It looks kind of like that, but covered in like feathers. It's like, it's so weird looking. It's like, I can't look at this. It's like, ew, go back. Like, you're yes. Not. Like, okay, it's like, you don't expect, like, because, like, and I think part of this too is like, because so many of us have been urbanized and like completely domesticated and tamed, we're completely lost touch with nature and stuff. where it's like things that are perfectly natural look weird to us.
Yes, absolutely.
Because we're not in touch with those, you know, we're not in touch with, like, we don't even know what our food looks like. Like, what it looks like in its natural state. It's like, you know, we get, say, cashews, and they're already in the jar or whatever, and we don't see the trees that it comes from. Or we get our coffee beans, they're already in the jar, in the little glass or plastic jar, and we don't know what plant it comes from. So, and then it's like, and then it's not, we're not even talking about, like, other things, like, that, you know, other things that we just use on a day-to-day basis, and it's like, they probably look weird because, you know, we're not living with, you know, we're not in tune with that anymore. Like, if we were, like, our ancestors living in, like, the woods or a farm or whatever, and, you know, we wouldn't be creeped out by some barn owls looking all scraggly looking.
Exactly.
It's like, oh, God, more of those. It's like, oh, you know, we'd probably be like, oh, great, they're going to be making a whole bunch of noise. Wonderful. And then just, like, go about our business. But yeah, it's just kind of interesting how our modern urban or suburban sensibilities have, you know, a distance from things that are natural, sort of like made the natural into this unnatural thing. But that's kind of a paradox that I guess is worth exploring in a different way. Unless I talk about Jaws, in which case I'm gonna talk about Jaws. But yeah, I think the thing you said about playing with history.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, especially like what we were talking about earlier about taboos and boundaries. And it's like, and I say this, and I don't like prefacing things with this. It's just because if I don't say it, people make assumptions and then they get mad.
Okay.
I am going to say I am Black and Jewish. So, but I'm also a horror fan. I have a horror, like, with my Jewish stuff, I have a horror podcast about horror and about how the, you know, these encounters with in the Bible, like the divine encounters in the Bible aren't necessarily uplifting. Mm-hmm. Like, horrific potential there. It's like, you know, the Bible is pretty horrific when you think about it. And I'm not even talking about, like, the part where they claim God tells them to kill people. It's like that, I don't even get into that part. It's like, you talk about plagues and monsters and, all these unnatural things that are going on around the people and things like that, or being lost on a tiny strip of land for 40 years. How do you manage that? So it's like, if you really think about it, it's like, that's kind of horrific. But then, you know, because it's the Bible, we're supposed to look at it or read it a certain way. We're not supposed to say, well, no, it's not really horrific. God works in mysterious ways, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, no. But, I mean, if I were like a Bronze Age desert nomad, I'd be terrified. I'd be constantly terrified. I'd be terrified of any of this stuff happening. But going along the lines, like playing with history and whatnot, it's like, as a descendant of slaves and as a Jewish person or a member of the Jewish people, you know, they're the big kind of elephants in the room, slavery and the Holocaust.
Hmm.
And it's like, and I'm not, and then here we come to this, to the taboo part where it's like, oh, you're not supposed to play with that, or you're not supposed to explore that. Especially in like an entertainment way. And I wonder, I don't know, I think because role playing is such a, is almost an empathy machine. So it's like, it can be a very powerful tool to explore a history. Safe-ish way, I guess, explore a history, like get close to it, but not take on the trauma. I don't know how to explain it. It's like, there's nothing, you know, yeah, this is a deeply serious topic and like it's potentially traumatic for a lot of people, but at the same time, there is a lot of But it's like, yes, it's deeply traumatic, but there's like mitigating circumstances, and there, I guess it'd be like this. Number one, if you present these situations as horror, mm-hmm. as opposed to adventure,
yep.
does that taboo about not touching that still, is it still there to the same extent? Like, if we present slavery as horrific, as opposed to where it's just like, well, we're gonna, you know, yeah, we're gonna like rah rah, take, you know, like, you know, it's just like a heroic fantasy, or the Holocaust as a horror show and not, you know, and I love Inglourious Basterds. Okay, I have all my problematic faves. I love Django Unchained. I love Inglourious Basterds. I love Mandingo. I love Roots, but. And it's like, Schindler's List is appropriately depressing. But, but you know, like those, you know, those modern twists on that history where it's like much more empowering, or it's more uplifting and triumphant, where, you know, but if you present slavery and the Holocaust, and I'll even add the Trail of Tears here too, because at least one of my ancestors was probably forced onto that. If we present those as like the horrors that they were and explore them through way, is it still inappropriate? Is it still being cavalier about that history? You know what I'm saying? Because like, I remember back in the 90s, I don't know if you recall when World of Darkness came out with that Holocaust source book.
Mm-hmm.
And when World of Darkness had the gypsies thing.
Yes.
And I never had a chance to look through them. Because, I mean, my friendly local game store didn't have them. But I don't know. It's like, how should I say this? Would it still be kind of insensitive to even for people within the communities affected by these horrors to, you know, use that in a horror context to have a game? You know what I mean?
I do. I think something that we'll have to be very careful. I think, firstly, that's the kind of thing that you would need to disclose to people before they play the game. Mm-hmm. But also the way that the person handles that has to be very specific. I mean, I don't think it can be trivialized in right. any way, shape, or form. You know, it's not something that should be used as a tool for the adventure to develop. So, for instance, and I'm going to be really brutal in here, so apologies to people, because this is going to be, you know, I'm going to go all out there. If you tell me in the middle of the game that you're going to use a pile of corpses to hide and be able to get into the base where you can then steal an ingredient that you can use in a spell to summon whatever,
mm-hmm.
I would say that's, I don't like that idea at all. You know, mm-hmm. that to use something that was very real, that truly happened, as a tool for you to do something completely unrelated.
Right.
But if you tell me that you are trying to get inside this concentration camp to stop it,
mm-hmm.
and that once you are in there, you find out that there is some horror that you didn't expect, and that you have to fight, that's unrelated to the Holocaust. So you have to do both things. And the Holocaust remains its own horror. I would run with that. I would probably run with that.
Right. Right.
But I wouldn't say, oh, the Holocaust is the creation of a higher being, because I feel that that would be trivializing the reality of the Holocaust. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think there's definitely a distinct difference between like taking that history and like exploring that history and maybe putting a supernatural twist on it, but not like that. But like, exploring that history and kind of putting a horror genre twist on it in the sense of, like, yeah, the reality was horrific enough, but now add these unreal elements to it. Versus something where, like, that history is just an aesthetic backdrop. It's sort of like, I'll tell you something that kind of, all right, you know about Interview with the Vampire, right?
Yeah.
You know how, and of course, the beginning of the story, the whole part with Louis and Lestat, and they meet, it was, what was the year in the movie? It was like 1791 or something like that?
Yes.
And he was the master of a large plantation. And the whole bit about, like, you have the pretty costumes and the neoclassical architecture, and you have the Parisian influence and all that, and yet all the slavery and the brutality of that is a backdrop, as opposed to, you know, front and center. Like, it's like his whole livelihood depends on slavery, and they're not even addressing it, you know? And it's like, kind of like, and that rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah, because it makes it as an accessory, you know, it trivializes. It's not, it doesn't have the importance. It's being used. It's like when the World of Darkness people released the Chechnya supplement, you know, and suddenly the very real massacre that's taking place in Chechnya became, oh, no, this is just a tool. This is just something that somebody has invented. This is too close to reality. This is too close to the bone. This is real for an awful lot of people.
Right.
Don't trivialize.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I actually have an example of something that actually did it kind of right. Where it's like, you can have like the horror, I don't want to say fun because it's not fun.
No.
You can add in the horror elements without making it look like, oh, slavery and the Holocaust were caused by
aliens.
Where it takes the humanity out of the horror.
Exactly.
It's like, for instance, there's I don't know if you've seen X-Men First Class.
Yes.
Okay. And you know how, like, part of the Holocaust, part of the Nazi thing and the Nazi science bullshit was them trying, like, doing all kind of weird medical experiments and weird science experiments, experimenting on people.
Yep.
You know, for whatever reason. And then I think there was, I don't know to what extent this is true, but like, there's like this occult thing that they were obsessed with.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you had a world where those powers were tangible, okay, I'll say it that way. If we had a world where those things were tangible, where there were other dimensions with creatures and gods and stuff that could be touched, and you have this horrific situation that's already horrific, and you say, okay, well, in addition to all the stuff that they were doing, the Nazis were doing, they were also toying around with this thing. Like toying around with like demonology or supernatural power, or like trying to get to develop psychic powers in people. And using human experimentation to like awaken psychic powers in people. I think that's okay. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't divorce the history from, it doesn't decontextualize that history. It's like, if these things were real and the Nazis knew about it, this is exactly what they would do. So it's like, okay. And it's the same thing with slavery, where it's like, no, I'm not going to make it so that the poor, innocent, white slave owners, they weren't really doing that. They were possessed by demons. It'd be more like, they're more likely to summon demons to be overseers than anything else. And again, like you're doing the human experimentation stuff, how to create a permanent underclass of exploitable labor. So like any horrors that develop out of slavery with a supernatural bent or a horror movie, like a clearly fictitious element to it, I think would come out of that history as opposed to being something where it's like, oh, this history wouldn't exist were it not for this supernatural element or this extraneous element. like slavery is horrific, for instance, but it's like, okay, now make it so that, imagine if the founding fathers were trying to seek immortality and using occult means to do it. Then it gets really kind of, and it gets kind of, and then it starts, yeah, it opens up a whole new can of worms, but it's like,
correct.
But that's kind of what they were doing, if it makes sense, where it's like, they kind of do, they want to rule forever. As an extra layer of horror to the situation.
Agreed.
But it doesn't make it look like slavery is the result of supernatural influence. Versus being a thing that they were doing already, and now they have this extra tool at their disposal.
Exactly. I think as long as the reality of it is not diminished, you know, the real horror is not diminished in any way, I think it's okay. But that is a very thin line that people cross very, very often, I think.
Yeah, and whatever you do, please don't romanticize it.
Never.
It's just, it's like that film, When Hands Touch, or whatever you want to call it. There are ways to have a cross-cultural romance in the context of the Third Reich. Well, screw that. I'm just going to call it the Holocaust, because the whole thing. Fuck Hitler. I don't care what he calls himself. There's a way to have that like love triumphs over evil kind of situation without it whitewashing, without it like erasing the evil that was Hitler's regime. Or downplaying, where it's like, well, I know that, yeah, he's Hitler's youth, but it's not really his fault. I'm like,
oh, come on.
Screw you. Like, I saw, because it's like, I've already seen Jojo Rabbit, and like, unless you're Jewish, I don't really want to hear anybody's opinions about like a Nazi Hitler youth or Nazi romancing a Jewish person or romancing a person who would really be a victim of the Holocaust. And I'm just like, nah, I can't with that. Yeah, that's my boundary. I think it's like, do not romanticize that. It's just not. No, don't do that to your players.
No, absolutely agree with you.
Yeah, but I think we've reached kind of, we had a great conversation. I think we've reached kind of the end of it. It went on longer than our usual ones, I think, but it was important.
Well, we can come back to this topic. You know, we can talk about the horrors of Christmas very soon.
Oh! I like Krampus. Yeah. Like Krampus, or whatever you called it. And I was like, well, what happens if you're Jewish? Well, Santa Claus gives you blah, blah, blah. But I don't know. It's like, but yeah, there's Christmas. Any November holidays? Well, Hanukkah, I don't know if there's a... I mean, Jewish horrors are very earthly. It doesn't come in the form of these people are keep trying to kill us. And, well, they didn't kill us all. Some of us made it, so I guess we're going to have a holiday now. They tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. So, I don't even, it's like, it's like, but Christmas would be interesting. So anyway, I think this wraps up this particular podcast. I had a fun.
Me too. This was actually very fun, and I tell you, if I didn't have to go out for dinner, I would be talking about this for the rest of the evening.
Yeah, so let's do this. I guess that wraps up our special Halloween episode.
Yes, but we have another one.
Yeah, so thanks a bunch. This is Sean Harris. Say hey, like, hope you enjoyed this session, and Papa Garcia, and we'll see you next time.
Indeed.